Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and our guest, Scott Craven, back once again. He comes by every couple of months to talk with us, and you know, you look outside, you got the turtles, maybe they're laying eggs, you got the birds feeding their young right now, you got wildflowers out there attracting pollinators. So there's lots going on, and I'm sure there's lots going on in your area where you live. And I hope you'll join in with your wildlife questions and what you're seeing out there. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry and listeners. It's great to be back, and it's a great time of year. And it's a beautiful day up here in the Northwoods, so things are good all the way around.
Well, you know, we've had a lot of rain and some pretty intense storms. You think there's been, and flooding a bit of, has it had much of an impact on our wildlife?
Well, only time will tell, Larry. This is a critical time of year. We're just coming out of a very critical time of year with the basic reproductive season for most species. And this is the time when virtually all populations, whether it's turtles, salamanders, songbirds, game birds, deer, bear, whatever, this is the time of year when the populations of those species reach their annual peaks. In other words, there are more deer on the landscape right now or were in June when fawn production peaked than at any other time of the year. And that's true for most species. So this is now the critical period for survival of the young. Obviously, they don't all survive anyway. Mortality is very high in newly born and newly hatched wildlife. And it has to be, if you stop to think about it, with the reproductive potential of some of these animals, if they all survived, we'd be knee-deep in a variety of different creatures. So the system has become well-tuned over the course of evolution so that even with high survival, there are enough that survive to replace the parents. And if conditions are good, resources are plentiful, populations grow. If it's the reverse, then they decline if mortality is too high. So that's what's going on now. And as far as the rain's concerned, that, while it could be a boon to some things like amphibian populations, like frogs and toads and whatnot, it's probably been in the long run detrimental, especially to birds that, like, for example, wild turkeys or pheasants or grouse or whatever, where their young chicks are scrambling around in the fields and forests. While they may try and brood the young, the rains have just been virtually torrential in some areas and some pretty severe storms. So I suspect it's been hard on them. But again, time will tell as we move on and see what the populations look like come fall. I suspect that for larger animals like deer and bear and so forth, it's perhaps been an annoyance, but not really anything that probably caused any additional mortality. But there sure has been a lot of water. I mean, up here looking at the lakes area, the lakes are high, and there's quite a bit of algae in the waters. In some cases, the aquatic plants are just coming up thick and vigorous. And as I look out the window here at our cabin, it looks jungle-like out there. There's just green vegetation everywhere you look, and it's lush and succulent. So yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
I know there was a new study out that suggests that there's a reduction in the reproduction of loons in northern Wisconsin, and maybe caused by greater than average rainfall, which leads to poor water quality. I think Chapman University professor Walt Piper published that piece.
Well, water quality is part of the issue, but just a lot of water is part of the issue, too. We had near home and just south of Madison, we had a sandhill crane nesting in a small, shallow farm pond, maybe a quarter of a mile from the house, and she was right on the side of the road, so everybody was watching her, and she had the nest on a little elevated mound of vegetation and mud. And as these rains kept coming, you could watch the water level rising, and pretty soon it looked like she was virtually sitting in the water. And then a big gully washer came in, she was gone.
Yeah.
And presumably so was the nest. So part of it's water quality, part of it's just water volume. And there's been a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, as a gardener, kind of enjoying the water and you know, and my flowers out front, I haven't, you know, last year, I'm sure there were times I was out there with a hose to water some of those plants, especially I had some potted plants out there, and I haven't had to do that this year.
No, as long as they're not under an overhang or somewhere where they can take benefit of the rain, it's been great in terms of minimizing watering, but it's also been great for the weeds, and it's been so muddy in my gardens that it's been very difficult to keep up with the weeds. Now, other things seem to be flourishing. I haven't been home now for a week, so I assume the tomatoes are growing. Usually my benchmark is my wife's birthday in mid-July when the first tomato gets picked, and I don't know whether we're going to make that or not, but I won't be home for a few days. I'll be curious to see, but it has been a boon. I have a pumpkin patch kind of out in the open where I couldn't water it anyway. And holy cow, those pumpkins look like tropical plants out there from a distance. So, yeah, it's been kind of a mixed blessing. And I suspect it'll eventually mean that some of the wildlife problems that gardeners watch out for, like, for example, moles. We had a dry year last year, and I never heard anybody complaining about moles. They had to stay deep where they had some soil moisture, but now they probably come to the surface to avoid soil moisture, and of course the worms are near the surface too, and other things they eat. So I would guess we'll start hearing about people saying, oh, what's digging up my lawn or garden? And so again, it's a mixed blessing. Some species benefit from this kind of thing, and for some species, it's a problem.
Well, Ellie in Madison emailed to say that the turtle activity has been awesome this year. Ellie works near the UW-Madison Vet School and watches turtles in Willow Creek on her lunch break. And they've seen spiny soft shells and painted turtles and snapping turtles making nests. And Ellie said there's a clutch of baby wood ducks, too. So...
Well, that's the kind of thing that people like to see this time of year. I've rescued a couple of painted turtles from the road up here in the last week or so. Of course, we're a little behind up in the Northwoods as opposed to what's going on in the Madison area, but the turtles are still nesting here. There was a painted turtle digging a nest in front of my garage a few days ago, and actually I was elsewhere, but my wife called and said, hey, there's a turtle nesting in the driveway. And I got back, and I said, okay, where exactly is that turtle? I wanted to cover the nest with some chicken wire and see if I could avoid the local nest predators getting it again. And we walked over, said, well, gee, here's a picture of it. And it says it was right by this rock and next to this dandelion and whatnot. And that turtle had done such an amazing job of recovering the nest cavity that she dug and then deposited the eggs in, that we literally could not be sure where she had just completed that nest.
Wow.
We had enough of a general idea so that I could cover the area, but I mean, it's just another one of those things in nature that amaze people, and you realize how efficient and effective these animals have become over many, 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 many years.
Yeah, absolutely. And what did you use to cover? What kind of screen did you put on those eggs?
Well, in some cases, the only critical thing is that it's strong enough to deter what could be a powerful raccoon or possum or skunk or sometimes even squirrels. So it has to be staked down so that they just don't knock it out of the way. And it has to be rigid enough that they can't crush it. But it has to have holes large enough that the little nestling turtles can emerge through the mesh of the wire, and away they go. So, staked, braced can work. But sometimes things like rabbit guard, which is a garden fencing, or narrow welded wire will work too. Hardware cloth is usually, it's firm enough, but the mesh size is too small to allow the baby turtles to get through it. So, you know, find something that meets those requirements, and then fabricate a bit of a dome and stake it down well, and there you go.
Scott Craven, our guest today, looking at the world of wildlife. Questions for him, you can join in too. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Great to have him back. And certainly as you listen in, tell us about your experiences or maybe your question about what's going on in the world of wildlife. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. You know, you mentioned turkeys and sandhill cranes. They're should be feeding their young. How are the various bird populations in Wisconsin looking right now, Scott?
Well, I think overall they're looking pretty good. You know, most people pay careful attention to some of the game species you just mentioned because they're obviously interested in a huntable population coming up with fall, or in the case of turkeys, next spring. If thinking about turkeys, for example, the state just came very close to setting an all-time harvest record this past spring, just with the season just ending, what, 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
There were somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 turkeys harvested, and that was pretty close to an all-time record, and that came at a time, frankly, it surprised me because yeah. It just didn't seem like people were reporting seeing the huge flocks of turkeys that we saw when the population was burgeoning back in the 90s and early 2000s. So there was some concern that not only here but around the country, turkey populations were retrenching a little bit after booming when they were reintroduced in the late 1900s in many different states. So anyway, that came as a bit of a surprise. So turkeys apparently were doing well. And I've seen quite a few broods, even up here in the Northwoods, where no one expected them to do very well in the first place. And I had, when I walked around the corner of my garden the week before last, before I came up north here, and there were 16 turkeys standing in my mowed trail, 14 little fuzzballs and two hens, which had either combined broods or one was helping out. And they scrambled off and seemed to be doing just fine. So all evidence suggests that the turkeys are doing well and maybe even better than expected. Pheasants, on the other hand, while there are still some pheasants out there, wild pheasants just haven't made much of a resurgence in any part of Wisconsin. Grouse populations, which are a big deal up here in the Northwoods where I am now, are we're still in the downward phase of the grouse population cycle. So while there are some grouse around, they're few and far between in most areas. I've not seen any young grouse while I've been up here, but that's just one person. But the callers are out there by the tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, Larry. So if they're out there seeing these things, they should give us a call and tell us what they're seeing. But overall, barring some issues from all the rain, a lot of populations seem to be doing pretty well.
Since
I mentioned grouse, sometime later in the program, if you think of it, ask me about Gary the Grouse. And that's kind of an interesting story up here in the Northwoods. And I know some listeners who have had similar experiences with grouse that behave as if they were tame. But we can get to that whenever you want.
Let's do it right now before we go to Richard and Two Rivers. You got my interest up now.
So as you know, I was up here most of the month of May working with the Wildlife Ecology Summer Camp over at the Kemp Natural Resources Station on Lake Tomahawk in Woodruff, Minocqua. And that, as you well know, is a beautiful facility, just a prime example of Northwoods real estate. And up by the shop, where there's a bit of a complex of buildings, apparently about, sometime in April, one of the staff people was parking his truck, and a grouse walked out of the woods behind the shop and walked right up to him and eventually pecked his foot and followed him around for a while. I said, wow, this is weird. Well, anyway, that's happened now daily for anybody who goes up there in the area of the shop and slaps their hand on their leg, makes any noise at all. The grouse, now known as Gary, in honor of the retired maintenance guy who left a year or so ago. Anyway, that's another long story. But Gary will come rushing out of the woods and rush right up to whoever's there. And literally, they have a little can with some corn kernels in it. You can put a couple of corn kernels in your hand, and he'll come up and peck them right out of the palm of your hand. And so for someone looking to get a good picture of a wild, albeit tame, rough grouse, Gary's now a well-photographed individual. But this bizarre behavior, you wouldn't think there's much survival value for a grouse to approach humans. But in this case, he's in a secure environment. And as of 2 days ago when I was over there, he was still doing his thing after 2 or 3 months now and following people around and letting them not quite handle him, but almost. Now, the reason I was interested in this, because over my 30-plus years as Extension Wildlife Specialist, it was an unusual year that I didn't get a call from someone somewhere in the state, often accompanied by pictures of a rough grouse exhibiting bizarrely tame behavior. And I remember people describing grouse that would come out of the woods when they started up their lawn tractor, and the grouse would come out of the woods and in some cases fly up, land on the individual's shoulder, and ride around while he mowed the lawn.
Yeah, I remember that.
In other cases, they'd simply come out like Gary does and approach people looking for a handout or acting a little aggressive toward them. But regardless of what the birds actually did, this was just bizarre and unexplainable behavior. And because there were so many reports of it, we started to look around in the literature, and it was mentioned in many authoritative books on grouse and grouse management and behavior. But no one that I've seen has ever come up with an adequate explanation for why certain individuals behave like this and become seemingly tame, although they'll peck at you and perhaps exhibit a little aggressive behavior. But nevertheless, they show no fear of people.
And it's always grouse. It's not pheasants or anything else.
I've never heard of a turkey or a pheasant or really many other birds doing this. It seems to be grouse, and I can't offer up an explanation. It's fun to speculate, but for someone who's got one around, it's a real conversation piece.
Let's go to Richard in Two Rivers. Richard, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to thank you for the show, and it's very interesting. I live on the lakeshore by Manitowoc Two Rivers area, and we have a large amount of pelicans that we haven't had. Well, they were around last year, but living here, this is kind of new to the area for me, seeing all these pelicans, and I'm wondering if they're one type, where they're coming from, anything you can tell me about the pelicans on the lakeshore.
And these are white pelicans.
Yep.
Yeah. There are a lot more white pelicans around Wisconsin than there were in years gone by. And there had been some historically on some areas like Lake Winnebago and Horican Marsh and on some of the bigger water bodies. And they'll fly long distances to feed on fish in larger water bodies like Lake Michigan. But in any event, the tide seemed to turn. And I'm struggling now to remember the years. This was probably a good 20 years ago. There were some huge colonies of white pelicans in the upper northern Great Plains the Dakotas, for example, and into some areas of prairie southern Canada, huge populations of tens of thousands of birds that up and abandoned or left areas that they had populated or nested in for years. And that was not well explained, but they started to turn up in large numbers, presumably some of the same birds, in other places, including Wisconsin. So it was a rather sudden boost to our population that seems to have stuck, because I see large numbers of them hanging around in some of the wetlands in Dane County in the spring. And the places that I mentioned a moment ago, like Horican Marsh, Lake Winnebago, the Great Lakes, and some other large water systems in the state, have pretty persistent and large populations now. And they're impressive birds. They're big. They're rather pretty with their white plumage. And, of course, pelicans have always attracted attention because of that huge beak and pouch underneath it and their fishing behavior. So they're around. They're apparently doing well, and they're apparently here to stay. So enjoy them for what they do. I haven't heard, I'm a little out of the loop now in retirement, but I've not heard many complaints about negative interactions with fisheries. But if there was any problem with the birds, that's likely where it would, or perceived problem, that's likely where it would come from. Now, if anyone's heard differently, we can again turn to the audience for more information, but I think they're here to stay.
Richard, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Arlene in Wausau will give you a chance. Hi, Arlene.
Hello, good morning.
Morning. Yes.
I have a mother skunk and three or four babies living in my woodshed, and I feed them cat food. And I feed them cat food up there to keep them out of the barn so they don't eat the cat's food in the barn, which I noticed her a couple of months ago. I noticed her coming into the barn, so I started feeding her in the woodshed. Now she's got babies, so what do I do with her?
Oh, boy. Well, generally speaking, feeding wild mammals, unlike birds, which is a hugely popular activity, feeding mammals often does not come to a good end, whether it's raccoons or skunks or possums or other things that seemingly become relatively tame or appreciate the feeding, whatever you want to call it, it usually ends poorly, potentially for the animals because they become very habituated to humans, and certainly for the people like yourself who now have a skunk and a skunk family that you'd like to see elsewhere. If you feel they may move from the area where you're feeding them into a larger building, like you mentioned a barn, then they're just going to become more problematic to deal with in the larger area. My suggestion is to find someone in the area, maybe a local trapper, or if you're near a metropolitan area, there'll be animal control services there you could call. But and it may just be a friend or neighbor who's got a live trap. But since they're habituated to feeding, I suspect it'd be very easy to catch in a live trap and then get rid of them, move them. You should probably check with the local wildlife manager, with the DNR, and be up on the current regulations. There are some issues with moving skunks around the landscape because of the risk of rabies. But if you can do that, or you can simply perhaps move them to a remote corner of your property or a friend's, then you know, make sure you're not getting in trouble with regulations and move them while they're still relatively easy to catch. Especially if you can catch the female, the little ones will be easy. And then simply find them a new home. Yeah. Otherwise, it's going to be a persistent hassle for you.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think it's time to strike while the iron is hot, so to speak.
There you go, Arlene. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Bayfield County, we'll go to you. Hi, Don.
Hey, last fall I had a ermine. Was living in my living in the wood pile. And yep. he was a great hunter.
What would he hunt?
Chipmunks.
Oh.
Well, you know, most people, it's going to be a mixed bag for the audience, whether they find that interesting to watch or, gee, I wish he'd leave the chipmunks alone. But an ermine is a short-tailed weasel. It's the one this was, so this one had a black tip on his tail?
Correct.
Yeah.
And he was snow white in the winter with a black tip on the tail. So anyway, there are a number of different weasels in Wisconsin, but ermine's one that's well known because they are common in people's wood piles. They're very energetic. They're, I guess, in terms of human terms, some people would refer to them as vicious, but the bottom line is they're just very effective hunters. They're very agile, mobile, and can negotiate in rather narrow quarters like the spaces in a wood pile, and any mouse or shrew or vole or chipmunk that happens to be in the area is a fair possibility to be invited for dinner. And if you got a chance to watch all of that, then you're a lucky individual. A lot of people never see such a thing.
Yeah.
Is he still there?
No, last winter he came and smelled my boots. And I started talking to him, and he sat down, and he listened to me as I was talking to him. That was cool.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So he's now disappeared.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh. Well, you may get another one back, and if you do, and find out that you enjoy that, then you can talk to him if you had success with that. But the old trick to get an ermine or any weasel out of a wood pile or down log, if you're sitting on a deer stand, for example, and hear something rustling around, you suck on the back of your hand. Make a sound like that, that they take as being a distressed mouse or other small mammal, and they're very curious and always looking for a meal, and they'll usually respond to that call and come right out of hiding, and you'll get a good look at them, give you a picture. So anyway, glad you enjoyed the experience. Maybe you'll get another one.
Yeah, thanks, Don. Appreciate it. JJ in Madison, your turn. Hi, JJ.
Hello. I just wanted to share a brief anecdote about the Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. My wife and I and our two-year-old love to go there during the rainstorms that we've been having, because you will just see tens and tens of frogs and toads and all of these things and turtles around, and it's a really beautiful setting to see all of those. We counted 25 toads one time and multiple American bullfrogs and lots and lots and lots of turtles. And so I was also going to ask about other great places to see frogs and different Wisconsin frogs and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right about Olbrich. It is a great place if you want to see toads and frogs. What about it, Scott?
Well, it's Olbrich's a beautiful place anyway,
yeah.
with or without the frogs and toads. But, basically if you, I'm trying to see how to approach this here. Whereas bird watching or going out looking for large mammals or whatever is a kind of a mainstream experience and something people seek out, amphibian watching is considerably less popular, perhaps because people haven't been adequately initiated into it. But if you're really interested in frogs, toads, and I'd throw salamanders in there, The key thing, I think, is to understand a little bit about their seasonal behavior. And then you can home in on places that are particularly good for watching. And that includes really any wetland complex, particularly larger, shallow wetlands with no fish. And then there are going to be abundant amphibians around. So seasonally, early spring through about now, all of the frogs and toads have been singing and joining and leaving the chorus with seasonal behavior. So the first ones are the peepers and chorus frogs and wood frogs, and then the toads join in and the leopard frogs, and then at the tail end this time of year, the green frogs and bullfrogs and so on. So you can home in on the calls and figure out where they are. On the salamander front, they don't call, but they do migrate to and from their breeding ponds, and usually by early February, when we get a bit of a thaw and a warmish rain, then there are tremendous salamander migrations in some areas, like there's a common one west of Madison by a wetland called Shoveler Sink, which is a waterfowl production area that our students go out and see every year when the salamanders are moving across the roads there trying to get to the pond where they'll ultimately breed. And that spurs its own activity of helping them across the road. So anyway, you can tune in on these seasonal behaviors and figure out where the animals are. But any big wetland where there's some either hiking trails or shore accessibility, or if you have a canoe, you can go out and find these animals relatively easily. That's the nice thing about frogs and toads. They stay put, and they advertise their presence. I'm looking out the window here at the cabin, and I've got a little flooded pond or wetland area next to the cabin, and it's quiet right now. But boy, 2 or 3 weeks ago, you really wanted to think about closing the windows at night for sleeping, because there was just a din, an absolute din of tree frogs and other late singing species here about 20 yards from the windows. So you find a spot like that, you'll be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Thanks, JJ. Appreciate the call. Eric in Madison, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hey, good morning. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I've got some stories about pheasants up in Monroe County, and we've noticed a couple times at least they would follow a tractor harvesting corn. They'd be right by the front tire of a tractor, a wide space tire of a tractor. And then another time we just drove a car out into a cow pasture, and these two pheasants followed us around in a circle. And we believe that from when they were at the hatchery, they were following the food cart. What do you think?
Well, that's possible, but it's also possible they were wild birds and simply caught on, like many species do, that there are human activities that stir up lots of food, whether it's a tractor harvesting so the waste grain is being spilled, or whether it's just a tractor or other implement of any kind stirring up insect life. I notice, for example, when I'm mowing my lawn on the garden tractor, all of the swallows in the area, all of a sudden, boom, there they are, and they're just following right along as I mow, swooping down in front of me, behind me, around me, catching insects that I'm stirring up. And or you see the same phenomenon when farmers are plowing.
Yeah.
In the fall, and the huge flocks of seagulls and other birds that have caught on to the fact that, hey, that tractor is turning over the soil, and look at all the worms and other tasty morsels that the tractor is turning over. So, and that extends to beyond birds to deer, for example, responding to the sound of a chainsaw. Loggers are very familiar with the fact that as they're logging an area, the deer quickly move in to take advantage of those tender treetops and whatnot and branches that are left behind after the logging operation, but provide food. So I guess the bottom line is animals are pretty adept at figuring out which side of the bread the butter's on, and I suspect that's what was going on.
There you go, Eric. Thank you so much for calling. Winna in Galesville, your turn. Hi, Winna.
Well, hi, how are you?
Great, yeah, appreciate the call.
Small talk. Let's cut to the chase, right?
Okay.
I have possibly a shrew in the house, and I'm wondering if Scott can help us figure this out. I saw it once, and it just ran across the kitchen under the stove, and it just looked too dark to be a mouse. And I also thought, a mouse, why didn't it hear me coming? I was clomping down the stairs and into the kitchen and flicked the light on, and saw it running, and it was at night. And then another time my husband was up in the middle of the night and saw it go under the bed, and he was able to see that it didn't seem to have much of a tail, and it seemed pretty long, like 3-4 inches long and dark. So we looked it up on the internet, and there is the northern, I think, shrew that's dark. And as we read about it, it seemed like we should be able to smell a musky smell if there was really a shrew in the house. So I was wondering what you think.
Well, it's quite possible that it is a shrew, a 3 or 4 inch long, very dark charcoal gray animal with a short tail. It would most likely be the short-tailed shrew. The scientific name is Blarina. That's the genus. They're incredibly common. Perhaps at certain times and places, the most common mammal in the state. And they do occasionally get in a house, but they're rarely a household problem like mice are. And in reality, they're in there perhaps because there may be mice, and they eat mice. So that the short-tailed shrew is actually, for most homeowners, if I know I've got a couple of them in the garage, my preference is to leave them alone because I know they're keeping down other things in the garage that I don't want in there, like mice, which are rodents and chew and cause a lot of damage. The shrews won't do that, but they will eat the mice, and they'll also eat large insects and other things that I don't want in there. The problem is if you think you've got some mice and you start setting snap traps or other traps to get rid of them, then the shrews become a bycatch. You catch them by accident, and all of a sudden, you know, they're gone too, which I'd rather not do, but sometimes you can't avoid it. If you are catching mice, and it is for other folks, in not necessarily in your case, you catch a mouse in the garage or under the refrigerator or whatever else, and maybe you don't find it for a couple of days. And when you do find it, there's really nothing to
stop.
Trap.
Oh, you broke up.
Are you there, Larry?
Yeah, you broke up a bit there, Scott.
Well, I was just saying that sometimes when you trap a mouse and there's shrews around, the shrews will eat the mouse right in the trap, and all you end up finding is the remains of the mouse, usually just the hide. So that's a good indication that there are shrews around. When they do get in the house, one way you'll know you've got shrews in the house, and this is sometimes other species of shrews, they'll often go for houseplants. And you'll see a little disturbance in the pot of your houseplants, a little dirt moved around or on the floor. That's a good indication that they're there. Bottom line, if you're uncertain what it is and you want to get rid of it, you can catch the shrews in a trap just as easily as a mouse. But shrews are carnivorous. They eat meat. You can catch them with peanut butter, and you do occasionally. But if you really think it's a shrew, put a little piece of tie or tightly tie on the trigger of the trap, a little piece of the lean meat of a piece of bacon or a small scrap of meat from last night's dinner, a piece of chicken or a little piece of beef or whatever you happen to have, and try that for bait, and it'll often be more successful than the peanut butter. But that's the solution. But the reality is, you asked about the musky smell. I don't think from one shrew you'd ever notice that in the space of volume of a house.
Yeah.
So don't worry about that part of it. And if the shrew's not bothering you, it obviously got in, so it has access. It may go out on its own. But if you want to trap it, for peace of mind, you can. That's the long and short of it.
There you go, Winna. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here in our state today with Scott Craven. Great to have Scott back, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Lots of callers online. We've got some emails, too. Let's go to Liz, though, in Delavan. Liz, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Larry, and hi, Scott. I am just wondering if I should be concerned. I've got what I think is, I'm pretty sure, I'm absolutely sure, really, it's a badger on my property. I'm kind of in a wooded area, so I'm not sure if it's in the wooded area or if it's coming from underneath my shed, because I've got like a crawl space under my shed. And I had groundhogs, and I had them here and for a number of years. And then I had a friend of mine use a old chainsaw, which was very loud and vibrated terrible. And he was getting down some old trees and stuff and stumps and whatnot. And after he left, I never saw those groundhogs again. And then when I saw this badger, I thought it was a groundhog, and it was eating leaves off of an old oak tree I've got in the middle of my yard that was hanging down. And he was on his hind legs up, and then he moved around. I saw
him. Oh, we lost her. She had she had a badger, and I think she was wondering, she may have been worried about it, Scott, or just an observation.
This is a little confusing, Larry. First of all, most people would welcome the opportunity to watch or observe a badger. I've never heard of a badger attack in Wisconsin or anywhere else. They're nervous, wary animals. They're essentially a big weasel. So I don't think there's anything really for her to worry about. Now, if on the other hand, it's living under a shed, so that there's an issue with the excavation, or it's right close to the yard, obviously, in case she's got pets, then there might be a source of concern. The idea that she saw it, though, you know, reaching up from its hind legs and eating leaves off an oak tree is a little confusing, because weasels are strictly carnivorous, and no self-respecting weasel would be eating an oak leaf off a low-hanging branch. So I'm wondering if it's the woodchucks back again and there's a case of mistaken identity. I don't know what to say. If it is a badger, wouldn't be overly worried about it unless it's causing the issues that I mentioned. But if it's a woodchuck, and it could be a big grizzled old woodchuck that's got a gray face, I suppose that there could be a case of mistaken identity there. But I'd be much more concerned about the woodchucks under the shed, because they can do so much, cause so much of a problem with their digging. So I guess if I wanted to solve or get to the bottom of it, I'd borrow a trail camera from somewhere and position it on a post where it can see the relevant sides of the shed and see what you get for pictures.
Yep.
And that'll confirm who the culprit is, and then the appropriate action will become a little more obvious.
Patty in River Falls, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Good morning. Whoops.
Yeah, good morning.
Connected. Okay, I'm going to step outside. This morning we were opening up the pool, getting it ready for the grandkids today, and I looked up, and there were probably about 40 white pelicans just circling overhead, right over us. And I'm wondering if, with all the flooding, if they're just sort of moving inland a little bit, looking for another pond. Anyway, they did it. They circled over us quite a bit. They flew away a little ways, and then they came back over. And I joked and said maybe we should step up on the deck and see what they do. But then they did fly away. And one other comment before he answers. When we first moved out here, we had a fieldstone basement. We still do, but we've fixed it up a little bit. But it was, you know, that sand, everything was coming apart. And we had mice, and I had those better mouse traps. They're sort of like a box that snaps down. And I'd go down and check the trap, and thinking that it just got tripped, but there'd be a head inside. And then I discovered I had shrews in the basement, too.
Oh, good story, Patty.
Well, that bears out our earlier comments that the shrews are your friends in some cases. So if they're keeping the mice under control and not causing any problem in their own right, don't worry, but take advantage of them rather than persecuting them.
The pelicans.
As far as the pelicans are concerned, you know, seeing a flock of pelicans soaring, catching thermals, and just slowly passing over the landscape is not uncommon, either while they're migrating, maybe moving from one food source to another. I don't remember if pelicans, when the breeding colony is in action, what the non-breeders do. But for some of the large birds like geese, they move on a short molt migration to other secure areas so they can molt. Anyway, there are a number of possibilities, but I see them occasionally soaring over my property, even in Dane County, and I know they're not headed for anything close by. So I think they were just passing through. Enjoy them for what you get to see.
Yeah. Thanks, Patty. Appreciate it. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. The lady that had called in thought she had a shrew in the house. What I like to use is Tomahawk live traps from Tomahawk, Wisconsin. They've got a lot of different size live traps.
Mm-hmm.
They have a nice smaller one that works great. If you get a chipmunk in there, you can release it. If you get a shrew in there, release it. You get a mouse in there, you drowned it.
There you go. Lee's right about the traps, so the live traps.
Oh, no, the Tomahawk traps have been around for many years. They're very popular. They're well-made. I pass by the Tomahawk, the trap factory or whatever, going to and from my cabin regularly, and they're very well-known traps across the country, and they come in a variety of sizes. The smallest one, I actually have one I use for chipmunks that works very well. If you can get one with small enough mesh so that it will hold a shrew, then you're good to go. But the shrews, especially the smaller ones, I think would pass through the construction wire on most of the traps. But they all, in their advertising material, if you go online, they talk about all the different models and sizes and what they're used for. So if you can find one that'll catch them alive, then that's one way to get your shrew out of the house and not have to harm it. So good idea.
Thanks, Lee. And Vern in Harvard, Illinois. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling in about your discussion of the grouse that seemed very friendly.
Yeah.
Yes.
In December, there was an article in the New York Times that was talking about a study that Pennsylvania State University is doing, and it appears that the friendly grouse, the friendliness is caused by a genetic mutation that they have.
Hmm.
And they discussed many different cases that they've had.
So a genetic mutation.
Interesting. I mean, lots of things are caused by genetic mutations, but I wonder what gene or what the mutation really is. Is it something that affects them psychologically or from an aggressive standpoint? I wonder. Well, I'll have to try and check into that and see what I can learn, because previously there's been no satisfactory explanation. So
yeah, so it was
thanks for the tip.
Yeah, thanks for the tip, Vern. Yeah, we have to look that up. Penn State University research shouldn't be too hard to find that. Maybe I'll look during our newscast and see if I can come up with it. And
well,
you can take a look, too.
Yeah, I've got some friends at Penn State in the wildlife program, so I'll lean on them as well. We'll report on a subsequent program.
Scott Craven, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today as we talk, and certainly you're going to be able to join in with your questions. Robert and Viroqua, you can hang with us, and you can join in too here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be right back.
Taking a look at the wildlife in our state on the program today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven. Scott, Extension Emeritus, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, comes by every other month to talk with us about the world of wildlife, and appreciate having him along. Callers online, let's go to the phones with Robert in Viroqua. Robert, thank you for waiting.
Hey, thank you, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. A couple years back, I was on my deck having a cup of coffee in the early morning. We live by the Bad Axe River, and I heard a little noise behind me. I turned around. There was a little red fox. There's a little red fox sitting right next to me. We had a little conversation, and it just gradually turned around and walked away.
That's did cool.
Did it come back for additional conversations?
Oh, you got Larry, I got a whole story here for you, buddy. So anyway, so I'm having a bonfire a couple nights later. Everybody goes to bed. I'm still sitting there. The fox comes up and sits right next to me. And, I talked with him for, 15, 20 minutes. He finally walked away. And two or three nights later, I heard some noise on the deck in the evening. And I went to the sliding glass door that we have there, and the fox was sitting there. And I sat down on the floor and tapped on the glass and talked to him for a few minutes. And there were actually two other times that he came back and talked to me. And almost 1 year to the day that I saw him the first time, he came back up to the edge of our property and just sat there about 50 yards away. And I was out on the deck having a cup of coffee, and we didn't say a word. We just kind of looked at each other, and I waved to him, and he just, stood up and then walked back down the trail, and that's the last time I saw him.
Oh, man. What a story. Robert, thanks for calling. Isn't that a great story, Scott?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's gratifying to hear about these encounters people have with wildlife that leave that leave memories behind and sensitize people to how cool these animals can be and why we should do everything we can to keep them around. Now, what's the explanation for a fox behaving like that? Who knows? But with some animals that are sometimes taken in as pups, whether it's raccoon or fox or whatever, and raised by somebody, and then the right thing to do is return it to the wild. Well, yes, it is, but sometimes these animals that are somehow conditioned to humans or lose their fear of humans, then become an issue with someone else. In this case, it was a very positive thing, and I'm not saying that's the explanation, but that's one of several that could explain that kind of behavior on the part of a fox.
Mm.
But again, just like the grouse, I had multiple stories like that when I was working. And in one case, a family of gray fox that were nesting, denning under a shed in Door County. And they got to the point where when the folks would come out to sit on their patio for cocktail hour, the foxes were eventually conditioned. They'd come over and sit on the edge of the patio, presumably watching the occasion. But I think the real motivation was the occasional cube of cheddar or something else that found their way off the happy hour plates to the foxes. So the animals can become panhandlers pretty quickly and easily. We just have to be a little careful that you don't push that envelope too far, because it compromises their survival opportunities later on.
Yeah. Robert, thank you for that story. That was a wonderfully told too, by the way, Robert. Thank you. Maureen in Shell Lake, your turn. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. This is my first time calling, so I am even a little nervous, but on the call.
No need to be nervous.
Right. Okay. So the caller that called in about the tomahawk traps, I thought that was awesome. Live trapping, put them back out there. They don't mean to be where they ended up. But, and I even laughed, of course, when he said the mouse just drowned them. But somehow I became a spokesman for mice because I feel like they've gotten in the wrong place. They need to get back out there, and they're part of the whole circle of life. You need the owls and the hawks to, that's their, you know, that's their food. So, you know, we don't want to take those away. I went so far as wrote a short little book called The Mouse Appreciation Book, because I feel like they don't get the respect that they need. They like, they don't mean to be in your house. Now, of course, I have to argue a little bit with my husband, because he certainly doesn't want me to be, you know, allowing mice in the garage and the shed and everything. But it's like, give me a chance. Let me live trap them. Let me get them out of here. So anyway, because I believe that that's not the way they should go. They shouldn't get drowned. They shouldn't get killed by us. That they should be out there in the world having their little babies and allowing the hawks and owls and their other predators to get a good meal.
Yeah. Maureen, I think that's pretty well said, Scott.
Well, it was very well said. And what to me, what it expresses is the fact that different people, everybody that I came encountered with, that I encountered over many years of doing this, and many thousands of people, be it on the radio or at shows or talks or whatever, you quickly learn that virtually everyone likes wildlife. It's just something that, whether it's birds, mammals, whatever, people enjoy seeing and interacting with these animals. That's great. The other thing you learn is that there's a wide range of personal attitudes toward these animals, ranging from unbelievable tolerance to, holy cow, these things are okay, but I don't want them anywhere near me, and I certainly don't want them sharing my house, whatever they may be. Could be bats, could be mice, could be something else. So you kind of do these things or talk about them in the context of realizing that there's no one size fits all when it comes to people's reactions to these animals. Now, in the case of mice, mice are rodents, and rodents typically enjoy an incredible reproductive potential, and they enjoy tremendous physical abilities in terms of their gnawing and chewing, which usually lead to damage. Now, the problem with mice in the house is that it was just stated that they don't mean to be there. Yes, they do. A house is a wonderful habitat for mice. So in my case, it's a matter of doing battle with paramiscus, the white-footed deer mice, usually called field mice, that seek out homes, sheds, garages, and so forth in the fall for winter shelter. They're there because they want to be. And once they find their way in, it's a two-way passage in and out of seasonal habitat. And given their free will, yeah, they'll move back out in the spring and disperse in the outdoor environment, and then they're back in the fall. And while they're in there, they can cause all sorts of problems. You can live trap them to get rid of them. You can snap trap them. You can do whatever you want. They enjoy no legal protection. And then that's entirely up to you. And I respect anybody's opinion to do with it as they wish. In my case, I just want them out. And it's not an easy proposition. It's a constant challenge if you live in a rural area. And it's a matter of your personal response and tolerance of these animals. But for the most part, sharing your home with any free-ranging animal, be it bat, mouse, or whatever, is not a great idea in the long run.
Well, Maureen, you can call anytime, and thank you very much for your call and your comment. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Mike in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have two questions. One about baby pelicans. I see a lot of baby ducks and baby geese on my river here, but I never have seen a baby pelican, even though there's all kinds of adults around.
Well, generally speaking, that's an interesting observation. I guess I never have either. They nest and reproduce in large colonies that tend to be as isolated as they can make them. And the young stay there in the colonies, and the parents bring food to them in the form of fish. and they grow very quickly. And by the time they can attain flight, they're pretty good-sized birds. So at can finally leave the colony and join the adults to learn the ins and outs of fishing and moving around the countryside, they're pretty good size. And you wouldn't, it would not be obvious to you that, oh, look, there's a little one, like you might see a little turkey that looks like a fuzzy baseball running around behind this big wild turkey. You wouldn't see that in the pelicans. They're ungainly, awkward-looking, large nestlings that stay in those ground nests in the nesting colony, and then eventually, once they can fly and move, then they join the adults and would be not indistinguishable, but not as easily distinguishable as the young of other birds. Yeah. That's the best explanation I can give you.
Yeah, that's a great explanation, actually. Mike, thank you very much for calling. We had an unnamed listener email to ask if it's possible to talk about wildlife without talking about hunting or otherwise killing them, which I think the last hour and 20 minutes we haven't, that's all we've talked about is not that. So I'm not sure where that came from.
Well, it's just an expression of the, you know, what we just talked about, in that different people have very different attitudes. And I understand people's sensitivity to an activity like hunting. It's it's absolutely an internet.
Yeah. Well, it's, and you broke up there a bit, Scott, but I think we've accomplished that goal this program so far.
Right. I do too.
Chris in Adams wants to know, what's the best way to remove snapping turtles from the road?
Cautiously. That's the best way to do it. They can get pretty big. And while the turtle itself, as the whole turtle, doesn't seem to move very quickly, the head and neck of a snapping turtle can move very quickly. And they have very powerful jaws. So if you're approaching one, the best thing to do is have a stout stick. And it will either grab and latch onto the stick, in which case you can drag it off the road, or you can prod it to get it to move. Or you can use the stick to hold it down, in which case you can get it by the tail. There's no harm to the turtle if you pick it up by the tail and move it that way, if it's light enough that you can do that. The tricky part to that is that you don't want it dangling next to your leg. Yeah. You have to be strong enough to hold it away from you far enough that it can't use that flexible neck and powerful jaws to latch onto your thigh or ankle or whatever while you're trying to do it a favor. So that's the least best alternative. I think the best one is to get it to latch onto something and hold on, so you can drag it out of the way, or have something, if you know, you carry a shovel or something in the trunk of your car, use that to push it or essentially get it off the road.
Paul in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good afternoon. I was at a place called the Little Red Cabin on Prairie Lake in Cameron, and I caught about a 1-pound largemouth bass, and I was just before I got to shore, a mink latched onto it and started chewing on it as I was trying to land it. It was the most amazing thing. And whatever I could do, I didn't want to just cut the line because I had a lure on there and I had the line and I don't like to do that. And even, I mean, this went on for a while. I have a videotape of it. I don't have access to it right now. But it was the most amazing thing. After he'd been chewing on it, he finally let go. I was able to release the bass, and it swam away unbelievably because, again, the mink had been chewing on it. Again, I didn't want to hurt the mink. I was going to let the bass go anyway, but it was extraordinary. I could try to send the video to you folks at some point.
I would love to see that, Paul. Thank you so much.
I would like to see it, too. I guess, Larry, I'm thinking we should write a book of some of these stories. Get the names of the listeners and collaborate on a book of wildlife stories. But anyway, Go ahead.
It reminded me of a time I was muskie fishing. We were camping and fishing on Black Lake in northern Wisconsin, and I couldn't catch any muskie. I had no luck. And so I thought, well, we'll catch some panfish for lunch. And so I'm fishing from the shore, this time with my ultralight, and I hook into a crappie, and I'm pulling the crappie in, and a big muskie comes and grabs the crappie. And I, of course, I've got an ultralight, so I just sort of held on for a while, and finally the muskie let go. I saw the muskie. It was a big one. And I reeled it in. I reeled in what was left of the fish, and it looked like one of these cartoon characters. The head was still there, but the rest, all the bones were there, but all the meat was gone.
Wow. Say, Larry, but this is sort of an aside, but I haven't seen you since or talked to you since the last show we did 2 months ago. But as you know, I have a long and distinguished fishing career, and I'm elderly at this point, and I had never caught a muskie, but I can't say that anymore after a couple weeks ago.
Oh, good for you.
I was fishing for walleyes with a jig and a minnow, and I caught, it was only a 30-incher. But it was a muskie, so I'm happy now. I'm content.
Good for you. Did you let it go or did you keep it?
No, I would never keep a muskie. I let it go.
Yeah.
You've conditioned me.
Well, let's go to Armin in Stevens Point. Hi, Armin.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my wife's garden is being overrun by chipmunks. We've kind of handled the red squirrel problem and the rabbits, but chipmunks, just far too many of them.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good year for chipmunks, Larry. I hadn't had any problems at home for a couple of years, but I seem to be overrun with them, and I've been running two little live traps, as one of the callers earlier mentioned, and I have very good luck with those. They're fairly easy to capture, but I'm getting tired of taking them to a nearby area where I feel I can find a new home and thrive. But you, if you're going to get into that, you better be prepared for a bit of effort, because you can catch one or two a day over a long period of time. My current record for the backyard is 26, and that's a lot of trips to and from the waste management facility, where there's lots of stumps and logs and boulders and rocks, and that's where I put them. But anyway, you better be prepared to deal with that, and that's why, again, some people take a different course of action. There are other ways to deal with the chipmunks in a lethal way. And as we've always talked about, some people are okay with that and some people aren't. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah. But
with that many chipmunks, you need to thin the herd, however you choose to do it.
James in Fountain City will give you a chance. Hi, James.
Hi. Say, thanks for taking the call. Couple quick comments here about moving snapping turtles, and I live right on the Mississippi, so I get the opportunity to do that pretty regularly. You really should never pick up a turtle by its tail. With snapping turtles, it can injure their structure, if you will. And what I've found, and I've moved many of them, an easy way is to carry a little snow shovel in your car, scoop them up, right, carry them across the road, and drop them off. But
right,
them up by the shell, and yeah, they snap, but they can't reach around and touch your hand. They can only go back so far. So you grab them by the shell and back, and hold on, because they're going to kick like a wild animal. And
their claws are sharp.
And you carry them across in the direction they were moving. You set them down. They're bye-bye. So
that's probably the safest way to do it, James. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. And you'd probably agree with that, Scott.
Yep, absolutely.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Well, you recently offered a class at some
your property, a few acres of your property. You talked about management of large rural or edge-of-town home sites for wildlife. How'd that go?
Well, I was doing some lectures for one of your sponsors for Wild Birds, and we were talking about kind of backyard management and something that's always, especially in suburban Madison and in larger metro areas where there's what some people refer to as urban sprawl, but people go out and buy 2 acres or 10 acres or 15 acres and plop down a house in the middle of it. And then the question is, what happens to all the acreage beyond that footprint of the house? And that was the gist of my discussion in terms of talking about what could be done to benefit wildlife on a small acreage parcel that maybe was former agricultural land or whatever it was formerly. What could you do with it? And we talked about possibilities ranging from prairie restoration to tree planting to water features to a whole host of things. And then I invited the people out to my home, which is on 12 acres, which was a former cornfield. There was not a stick of woody vegetation on that property when I purchased it 25 years ago and built a house. And now, well, as you know, Larry,
it's beautiful.
You would never know that it had been a former crop field. The prairie restoration takes up 10 acres, and there are thousands of trees planted and whatnot, and a water feature that people were very interested in. But the people responded very well to that. And I think the take-home message is that if you have several acres, you don't have to struggle to maintain a huge lawn. You can restore a variety of native habitats, and the wildlife won't care. They'll take advantage of that. And around my 12 acres now, where formerly there was probably nothing when it was in production, we've got all kinds of turkeys and deer and coyotes. And in the case of my water feature, I've had 7 of the 12 species of frogs and the one toad, 7 of them show up in that pond with no help from me. And I, for the life of me, don't know how they get there across country, but they do. And for the frog lover who called earlier about places to go and see frogs, you can bring the frogs to you with a good water feature. So anyway, I found that very rewarding, and the people seem to enjoy it. And for folks who have a couple of acres, get in touch with me, and I'm happy to give you some advice.
Well, Scott, on that happy note, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much, and you'll be back with us in September, I think.
Yes, I believe so.
I believe it's September. I think. But I appreciate your time now, and we'll look forward to it, your next visit.
I look forward to it as well. Happy 4th of July to you and all the listeners.
Scott Craven, our guest, Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Coming up, hey, the 4th of July coming here, and I bet you may be grilling. And we've got some good information coming for you about that next from Mad Dog and Merrill. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. I don't know about you, but I'm hoping it doesn't rain tomorrow on the 4th of July for a lot of reasons. But one of those reasons is I don't like grilling in the wet, in the rain. And I'll do it anyway because it's sort of a tradition. And I'm betting our guest today, Mad Dog and Merrill, will be out there grilling as well. Mad Dog and Merrill are better known. They're nationally recognized grillologists. They are the hosts of the TV show Mad Dog and Merrill's Midwest Grillin'. And they have written several cookbooks together. They've got some spices that I like grandma's spice the best, I think, of it. I've used that the most, at least. And they're with us to talk about 4th of July grilling, and I hope you join in with your own experiences or maybe your own questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mad Dog, are you there?
I certainly am, Larry. It's good to hear your beautiful voice.
And Merrill, I hope you're there.
Oh, of course I'm here. I wouldn't leave you, that's for sure.
Well, it's good to have you guys back. I expect you're going to be grilling. Are you going to be working, or are you going to do it for family and friends?
Family and friends.
I'm doing mine for family and friends here, too.
Well,
yes, sir.
I tell you what, is there a single day in the whole year where more grilling is done than the 4th of July, do you think?
You know, it's just absolutely amazing, isn't it? And people are firing up the grill more and more, and there's so many different technologies and so many different grills on the market nowadays. And we've seen the evolution of the grill industry, haven't we, Merrill?
Well, we certainly have. I mean, we've came a long way, but it's amazing that when we first started, it was just the charcoal grills, and now we've got the pellet grills. Obviously, you got the grill tops, you got the gas grills, you got the Komodo grills. It's just amazing how far we came along.
Yeah. What do you guys? What's your grill of choice when you're out there? Well, Merrill, start with you.
You know, I'm using them all. Even matter of fact, even tomorrow, we got the grandkids coming up. So, seriously, I'm using the charcoal grill, I'm using the pellet grill, and I'm using the gas grill. I think I divide them up all pretty well evenly all the time.
Mad Dog, what about you?
You know something, I'm into the pellet grills. You know, for the television show, we use a lot of pellet grills, and the griddles are phenomenal. You know, those flat-top griddles, people refer to them as black stones. But, you know, there's so many different name brands on the market nowadays. So I do a lot of pellet cooking, and it's just amazing. The pellet grills are amazing. They're accurate. They're easy to use, almost foolproof. You know, they're great.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that the temperature control on those is you can do that pretty fairly easily, right?
If Merrill can do it, you can do it, Larry.
You better believe it. Larry, you just push a button and you're all set. I mean, it's just amazing with the technology. But, you know, you could go ahead and smoke at 180 degrees. You could cook up, you know, steak up to 160, I mean, up to 360, 600 degrees if you'd like. They've got a sear station where a flame comes up underneath where you can sear your steaks. It's phenomenal with the technology that they came with the pellet grills.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I have two pretty large Weber's charcoal grills, and then I have one Cadillac of the gas grill Weber's. It's got so many burners, I hardly know what to do with all of them. And and I hooked that one right up to the house to the natural gas, so I didn't have to worry about tanks all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's a nice way to go, and I only use the gas grills primarily for turkeys or large chickens or things like that, because I, frankly, for just cooking each night, I just kind of like to put some charcoal out there.
Well, it's amazing. You know, we thought we'd lose, you know, how we're, you know, technology in the world and the younger generation. We thought we were going to lose a generation or two to grilling, that they wouldn't want to be in the outdoors. They wouldn't want to fire up a grill. But the great thing about it is there is technology involved with, I'm going to say, the pellet grill industry again. But the pellet grill industry, you know, they got an app on their phone. They got probes they can use. They got technology that way. So it's drawing the younger generation. We're talking the 25, 30, 40-year-old men and ladies that are firing up the grills. And they're smoking all the time because it's a pellet grill. It's a great. We really thought we were going to lose a generation of grillers, but we're gaining more and more. So it's wonderful.
So, when it's July 4th, you know, tomorrow, I tell you, I always fall back on it just because it just feels like 4th of July-ish to me, is trying to make some cool hamburgers, and I'll fool around with hot dogs or brats
just because it's the 4th of July.
Isn't that crazy? It's a tradition. It's like we always do red, white, and blue burgers. So we do tomatoes, white onions, and blue cheese. And it's just to us, that seems like the all-American burger, the red, white, and blue. So, and then we do, of course, our jalapeno poppers wrapped in bacon, and that always seems to be like a little firecracker because you got that little tail end like a fuse on the jalapeno. So it's like we call them firecrackers. That's as close as I get to lighting any firecrackers. Let me tell you that is eating a jalapeno popper too.
Right, especially at your age.
Especially at my age, you dang toot.
See, how's that TV? How's your TV show doing? Pretty well.
You know, it's going great. It's amazing how well it is. It really is. You know, we tape about 26 shows a year. Every show airs then twice because there's 52 weeks in the year. So they rotate quite a bit. It's really great. You know, we have a piano man, Fast Freddy, on the keyboards that plays with us. And we're in like Baton Rouge, Louisiana, starts out this coming month. Kansas City, they're watching down now this coming month. They're starting to watch Kansas City. It's in 35 states and 140 markets.
And man, from where you started... And you guys?
We were pushing 8-track tapes for commercials in the radio for you when we came down to Madison to be on with you.
oh my gosh! Well, I love the idea of the red, white, and blue burgers. When do you put the cheese on?
Right at the end, just for serving, and even the onions and tomato. You know, it's basically a nice hamburger served to everybody's perfection, whether it's 135 or 150 or something like that, you know, whether it's medium rare or well done. They get to that point, and then you top them. For that, you top. You know, the cheese you don't want melting, and the onions, you know, you can put the onions on first after you flip the burgers, and then if people don't want real raw onions, they'll cook within a minute or two, you know, just sitting there on top of that hamburger that's hot.
Yeah, I think it's – and Meryl, are you doing the same kind of thing?
Well, you know what, believe it or not, no. I got the grandkids coming over tomorrow, and it's sort of fun. They're excited. They're bringing their friends over, but we're doing actually what we call Meryl Sombreros. That's actually taking a flour tortilla shell, and on half of that shell, you fill it up with your sauce, your cheese, your onions. So each kid gets to make their own sombrero, and they make their own. We've got it set up. We've got the cheese. We got spinach out there. We got some peppers out there, onions. They make their own. They give it to me. I put them on the grill. I grill them about 2 or 3 minutes on each side. Then I cut them in half, and they're all happy campers.
Some people call them a quesadilla. We call them Meryl Sombreros.
Oh, man, I like that.
All the way.
You know, I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad. So I lived in Trinidad, and this is a long time ago now, and I had never eaten goat until I got there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I tell you, that's pretty much, you know, because in the islands there aren't that many cattle and so forth. So the primary meat was goat.
You know, we just got through cooking goat chops. We were at EAA, the EAA grounds in Oshkosh, filming a show, and we did goat chops, and they are the most delicious thing in the world. It's like bison or it's like venison. They're a dense protein, and if you overcook them, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So it's something you want to serve 135, 140. If you get to that 150 range and they're done, you know, it just loses its edibility somewhat. You know, you just want them rare or medium rare, but they're a delicious cut of meat. They're actually milder than lamb. There's a couple of great companies in Wisconsin that actually will ship anywhere in the United States for the goat.
Well, I got so that I really liked it, and of course you come back to the U.S. and you don't see it as much or at all.
Yeah, there's a company called Cylon. I pronounce it Ceylon. I don't know how they pronounce it, but it's over by La Crosse and Eau Claire and that neighborhood over there, that part of the state. But they'll ship anywhere in the United States, and we actually have a leg of goat that we'll be cooking in the next couple of weeks on television, too. And there again, it's got to be 135, 140 degrees or forget it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the same with venison. I mean, there's a lot of venison sitting in freezers that's probably been some of it thawing for tomorrow's grilling.
Exactly right, and the same principle applies. It's a beautiful cut of meat. It's very lean. It's very dense protein, dense meaning there's not a lot of marbleization. Same with bison. Bison's really, really good for you. It's healthy, but it's one of those that you learn to cook it properly and you don't change your way of doing it.
Is there any secret to getting the perfect burger on the grill? Now, I have undercooked and overcooked many in my days, but I've also gotten some pretty good ones too. What's your secret on the perfect burger?
Mine, I definitely like doing mine, you know, direct, maybe a couple minutes on each side, then move it over to the side where there's no heat and cook it to your desired deadness. You know, definitely use a meat thermometer. I know we've talked about this plenty of times, but definitely use a meat thermometer and you'll get your proper doneness how you would like it.
I recommend to everybody, because we want to celebrate America, that Ben Franklin was right, and I did grilled turkey burgers last night.
Oh.
And turkey should have been the national bird, and not the eagle. I love eagles, don't get me wrong. I won't say that. But turkey burgers, that's what Lori and I eat probably once a week. And the same principle, you know, I'll sear up a side, I'll flip them over, and as soon as I flip them over, I turn the heat out from underneath that burners, and I just slow cook them with the other side on, and it is more of a touch for me, and they stay moist. They're just the most gorgeous burgers in the world. You know, we'll top them up with different things. In fact, that's what we're actually doing tomorrow is turkey burgers again.
So but you're not going to throw ketchup on a turkey burger, are you?
No, it's a red, white, and blue. It's a red, white, and blue. No, you know what we do? We make homemade mac sauce.
Oh.
You know, I make that mac sauce with a mayo and mustard and ketchup and pickle relish and a little dill relish and just a pinch of vinegar just for fun. Yeah.
Man, be hungry.
Oh, man.
I haven't eaten yet. I'm hungry, too. Mad Dog and Merrill, our guests today. They have appeared all over Wisconsin, and they've actually appeared around the country now with their TV show. It's been going great guns. Mad Dog and Merrill's Midwest Grillin'. If you went online, plug that in, you're going to find the stations near you that are carrying it. Great to have them with us. Questions for them or maybe a grilling experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234 or email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking grilling with our guest Mad Dog and Merrill. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I wanted to bring up the question of what would I call it? Sanitation. You know, there are some guys, and I've been known to do it myself on occasion, when I go to my grill and I start the grill up and I might take my wire brush while the grill is on fire, the coals are on fire, and I will just rub that wire brush over the top of
grates.
The grates. That's what I was trying to say.
Yep.
And then there are other people who will say, that is the most unhealthy thing you could possibly do. What are your thoughts on the grates and grilling with those?
Well, first of all, I think you really don't. Obviously, if you got a gas grill, you want to preheat that first. But really, wouldn't recommend using the wire brush, because the wire brush has got those little wires on there that could come across. So I like even using something like a scraper, or you can get different brushes out there in the market that do not use wire, but clean it off very well. That grill gets plenty hot. It's going to kill off the bacteria. That's how I look at it.
That's
That's how I look
Wait, I look at it. I scraped the ever-living dickens out of it with that wire brush, but then I take a piece of a wadded-up paper toweling, and I wipe it clean with a little oil as I'm doing it afterwards. And I feel I'm serving a purpose doing that, the oiling on top, plus I'm cleaning the grill with that. I use the wire brush, but I wipe it off is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I had somebody look really askance at me when they were over for a grilling one time. They said, "You mean you didn't wash the grate?"
I'll tell you, we run into a lot of people that do that. They'll constantly, they'll clean the grates every time that they're done and everything. But no, you're doing it the right way, Larry. You're doing fine.
Keith and Hilbert's got something for us. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yes, I was listening. I'm in my car, and I live in Hilbert, like you said. Well, just south of there is Chilton. And there's just south of Chilton, there's like a creamery or a cheese plant that makes goat cheese. Well, the people who own that also supply their own milk for that and have their goats. And so they have a surplus of goats. So they also have a meat market right in, just outside of Chilton there that's what they specialize in goat meat. So
absolutely,
I don't remember the place.
Yep, it's called LeClaire, I believe.
Right.
LeClaire Creamery.
Yep. And the same people own the meat market as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Larry and Claire just sold that to somebody or some company, but it's still the same goats and still everything else. But they just sold out after several years. They did a good job we taped the television show there about 4 years ago with all goat cheeses, and just absolutely delicious.
Yeah. Keith, thank you for calling. I wasn't aware of it. Appreciate it. Dave in Minocqua will go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I years ago picked up the notion or the information that when grilling, if you burn the fat like on a steak and you eat that, you're ingesting a cancer-causing agent. I used to like that as the best part of the steak, but I'm wondering about that question. I've always had that in my mind, and I'm asking the question about it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's such a debatable thing. You're burning the natural carcinogens, the natural sugars of the meat, and you don't hear about that so much anymore. So you wonder if that wasn't something that was just not necessarily fabricated, but just assumed. You know what I'm saying? Larry's still here, and look at all the meat that man's burned.
You know, it was a big thing about, I don't know, 10 years ago, but don't hear that much people
ago.
Talk about it anymore, you know?
It's been more than 10, 20.
20 some years ago at least, yeah.
Oh, I forget how old I am, Larry.
Yeah.
Well,
as old as that leather jacket you wore.
Tim emailed to say he's planning to cook lake trout fillets on the grill this week. Any suggestions to do this or should you not use a charcoal grill?
No, that's great. Leave the skin on them. Lake trout, leave the skin on because that protects the meat product. And that's where the majority of the omegas, the good rich oils, lay. That's going to keep that meat moist. And it's just we use a coffee rub. Right out of the canister, the pre-perk grounds before you put it in the Mr. Coffee Maker. 2 scoops of coffee, 2 scoops of your master herbs and spices. And it's normally 2 scoops of brown sugar. But when you're doing salmon or lake trout, you double the brown sugar. So it'd be 4 scoops of brown sugar. Just a tad more sweetener and mix it all up. And that's a gorgeous rub for lake trout. You slap it skin side down and you don't have to turn it necessarily. It'll bake, grill up real nice. The skin gets more crispier. And then you just take a spatula and work between the meat and the skin. When it's done and when it's firm to the touch and the white little bubbles on top, that's the protein's being cooked and pushed to the top. It's perfect. Don't overcook it. That's for sure. When you start seeing firmness in the thickest part, that baby's done. And it's delicious on the grill. It really is. Maple glazes, barbecue sauce glazes, teriyaki glaze over the top of it. Whatever you want to do, it can host the flavor of anything.
So you get the
skin away from the meat itself when you're taking it off the grill.
Correct, and that skin will stay right on the grates of the grill, and then you use your wire brush and scrape it off.
I like how you think. For sure. You know, you mentioned sauces and so forth. I was on to your store, your online store. Man, you and I hadn't looked there for a while, but you have expanded. You've got hot sauces and rubs and a lot of different things on that online
barbecue
store.
Barbecue sauces, yep. Grill cleaners. We got a grill cleaner now. Yeah. It really is. You know, and Meryl and I, it's in several stores. The spices are hard to get in any store. They really are. Spices are hard to get in stores. The barbecue sauces, we're in several of those. The best way to get those is online or, you know, go to the calendar of events on our website. Wherever Meryl and I usually are, we bring along sauces and spices ourselves to sell back because people are looking for them.
What about apple pie? I heard, I think Joel told me, Pat Nod told me this, that you make apple pie on the grill.
Just absolutely delicious. I use a pizza stone. Boy, if you don't have a pizza stone for pizzas and everything else and for biscuits on the grill and quesadillas, they're great. But I just go get a Pillsbury pizza crust, and I fold it out, and I just roll the edges up like you're rolling up just to have a little bubble on the edges just so you have a base, and literally take sliced apples and layer them over the top of that. I'll put melted butter and brown sugar together as a rule, cinnamon and nutmeg, and just drizzle it over the top. And all you simply do is heat up the pizza stone, slide that onto the pizza stone. You can even make it on the pizza stone and just wait a little bit longer to get it cooked. But it just cooks up in no time at all. Work a spatula underneath the pie crust every once in a while so that nothing's bubbling underneath the stick. And, I mean, I got it down to perfection. You just have to try it at home. You can use cherry pie filling. You can do all, you know, different types. I like to make homemade apples. But it's just so delicious, and what better thing to do for the weekend than hot dogs, apple pie, and baked beans?
You know, that makes how long on the pie? How long is it going to be?
If your pizza stone's already pre-cooked and you're using that thin little crust, it takes a matter of 5 to 8 minutes, 10 minutes at the most. Oh. You know, it cooks up really, really fast. Now, if you turn the heat off after a while underneath it and leave a indirect type of thing, once it crust is crispy, then you can cook it till it's a little more bubbly and stuff like that. So I'm going to say 15 minutes or so. It doesn't take long. You're just cooking those little apples just barely through, and you got the butter and the brown sugar, cinnamon and nutmeg on there, maybe a little allspice.
Boy, that sounds good to me.
Boy, you can do it with just about, you can do a pecan pie, you can do a raisin pie. You can do just about anything. You know what I'm saying? Raisin pie, like I'm an old man.
Raisin pie.
Oh, boy.
It's not. Well, I haven't had a raisin pie in a long time.
It's not as current as it used to be.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, boy. Current raisins. Current. All right.
You're
I got
exactly
it.
Right. Yeah.
So those jalapeno poppers, by the way, in our last 30 seconds or so, do you bread those peppers?
No.
You just throw them on the grill, don't you, with wrapped around some bacon?
Absolutely right. Take a good paring knife and slice off one of the sides. You hollow out the seeds. If the in-laws are coming over, you can leave some seeds in there for them. But my favorite one is about two or three little strips of pepperoni, little round circles of pepperoni pushed inside that jalapeno, followed up by a couple of cheese curds, and then you mummify it in bacon.
Ooh.
And that's just as easy as it gets you. You can do the cream cheese mixtures and stuff like that, but they get awfully messy. But mozzarella, string cheese, or a couple of cheese curds pushed down in there with a base of a couple of little pepperoni rings, and then you mummify it in bacon. That's what I'm doing this weekend. That's what I'm doing on the weekend coming up after that.
Well, Mad Dog and Meryl, I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. It's always fun, and we got to have you back where we can spend some more time. Go take a look at Mad Dog and Meryl if you just type that in. Midwest Mad Dog and Meryl's Grilling Buddies, you're going to find them. Thanks to our whole staff here today. It's Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, and Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, wishing you on behalf of everybody a happy 4th, and stay with us. Lots in store.